This is Justice Radio, a weekly show on WMPG with your hosts Mackenzie Kelly and Linda Small. Today we are talking with Ray Sage, the policy coordinator for the Permanent Commission on the Status of Racial, Indigenous, and Tribal Populations. And Ray is committed to policy work to empower Maine's marginalized communities.
But first, a little information about us. I'm Mackenzie Kelly, a recovery coach and peer mentor coordinator of Healthy Acadia and the program director of Reentry Sisters.
And I'm Linda Small, a project coordinator with the Maine Prisoner Advocacy Coalition and executive director of Reentry Sisters. We're an organization that specializes in helping women and girls return home from prison. You can learn more about us at reentrysisters.org.
Today we're talking about the Permanent Commission. What is it and what is its strategic plan to center criminal legal reform and other issues impacting Maine's underserved communities? We'll begin with an introduction. Ray, can you please tell our listeners about your background and what brought you to the Permanent Commission?
Yes, thank you very much, Mackenzie. My name is Ray Sage, pronouns she, they, and the long and winding road that left me as the policy coordinator for the Permanent Commission. Essentially, when I was thinking about myself as a political individual, I used to say, I'm very political, but I've been pretty political my whole life. I think from the experience of being a Black woman, from the experience of moving around a lot in growing communities, and also I think a lot of young people kind of identify with always having that inclination towards the justice, seeking justice for the self, for the others, for the friends, for the people in your communities and spaces that you see having harm done to them. So I've moved away from being I wasn't a political person. I think I've always been political. I served in the air for 6 years. And then afterwards, when I was getting out, I was thinking a lot about where I want the trajectory of my life to go. I'm sure you can imagine service in the military radicalizing. So was what I did after, which is I stepped right into farm work, which is something I always wanted to do. This was at the beginning or in April of 2020. And so naturally, extremely politically charged moment, also not just as a person getting out of the military, but also as a nation. So going from military to farm work, then from there, getting my massage therapy license, it taught me a lot about the way that trauma informs the way that we all move through the world and informs the way that we experience everything. And I think a lot of care and service providers can identify with this understanding that you provide care for people long enough, you really get a deep look at the way that a lot of people's harms that they experience are the root, are rooted in systemic failing, are rooted in the failings of healthcare, are rooted in the failings of government, federal government, state government, and local government, rooted in racial inequities. So you see these common threads underneath everybody's physical and mental traumas. You start kind of pulling on that thread and figuring out where can I be most effective based on my skill set, based on my capacity, and based on what I have to offer as well to my community. So did body work for a while, still do it. And from there, I realized that I did have a lot of skills that I wanted to figure out how to use to serve my community. So that from there, I started interviewing jobs. I first interviewed with Land in Common. And then after that didn't work out, my dad works for state government. And he was posting, this sounds kind of similar to what you were hoping to do with Land in Common. And I was really hesitant at first, because after my experience in the military, I was pretty adamant about never working for state government again or never working for the government again. But I interviewed, and I just really had such a deep affection for the team, for the people that I was interacting with during my interview process, for the tenderness and care that they all showed. And so even though I had my resistance and still even sometimes do, it just seems like such a good fit. And I've been in this position for about a year now, having never done any work before, but doing work in the military that was all about analysis and presentation and public speaking. So I had like a lot of skill in this space. But really, in the year that I've been in this position, I've just learned so much. I grew up in Maine, but not until I was in this role, because I've always primarily lived rurally. Not until I was in this role did I get the opportunity of such a deep and nourishing perspective on the communities of color in Maine and what the reality of what they're experiencing. So I'm like beyond thankful for this position. It's a blessing all the time.
Oh, that's awesome. Thank you for that background and welcome for being on our show. There's so many things that stood out to me. I'm going to say one of them is when you were talking about tenderness and care, which seems like an oxymoron when it comes to government, right? And politics. These are words we don't normally connect to one another. So we're thrilled to have somebody like you who's understands trauma history and does body work. So you get it. And it creates a deep connection to people who desperately need some assistance from the government and who normally don't have a voice. So it's wonderful that you're there, right, to raise those particular voices. So can you share with our listeners a little bit about, you know, what is the Permanent Commission and a little bit about its goals?
Absolutely. So the Permanent Commission is an independent state agency. And so we are in government, but also a step outside of it. And I think because our mandate is to address and, inquire about systemic racism, that a little bit of separation is necessary because, you know, we're inherently contemplating a system that we also exist within. So there's a little bit of paradox within our work sometimes, but it's really, I think, a really, really critical position to have seats within the government who are contemplating racial equity within all manners of rulemaking, within research, within the way that the government engages with communities. So it's really, really cool to be a part of that, like evaluation and introspective, because it is a form of introspection to be a state actor asking questions about systemic racism, right? My goal specifically within my policy position is to advise and support executive, judicial, and legislative branches of government in that evaluative process, and also to uplift the voices of communities as they're telling us what they want and need. We're really rooted in providing resources to communities and also to the state about the realities of racial injustices in Maine and racial disparities through the publication of reports, through the providing of grants and other types of resources, trainings. So our work is like really multifaceted. I think also from my perspective, one of our jobs is to, in the long run, because we're still a new agency, and in the long run, our goal is also to model ways that state government can engage with the people that it's meant to support in a place of compassion, understanding, and care. And I think more than anything, truth. We see this in our partnership with Wabanaki Reach, how we're like hosting these trainings for folks all through the executive branch, all sorts of state actors. We just did a training for legislators at the State House, which was incredible. You can see that we are trying to advance the truth of history, the truth of people's experience, and challenge dominant narratives about what's really holding these different communities back and preventing them from prospering and, you know, having that life, like, you know, that main adage, like the way life should be. Like, yes, that should be accessible to everyone. And let's ask ourselves why it's not. So that's my quick synopsis.
Yeah, love that. The way life should be. Sometimes I'm driving back home from out of state and I'm like, we either need to live up to that or we need to change that slogan, right?
Yeah.
Over to you, Mackenzie.
Yeah. I was wondering if you could actually, and thank you for that, by the way. I was wondering if you could talk to us a little about the trainings that you're hosting.
Absolutely. It would be my honor to, because I think we just had like, it's been such a pleasure to work with Wabanaki Reach. It's also been such a pleasure to participate in their trainings multiple times as I like support the facilitators and, you know, call different government agencies in to receive the training at the Permanent Commission office or at the State House. Mm-hmm. So one of the main ones that we've been doing is one called Interacting with Wabanaki Maine History. And it's this beautiful interactive training where there's a map and you are taking the position of a Wabanaki individual and walking through the steps of and realities of colonization together. And there's different speaking roles and different actors playing different parts. And it is such a visceral and emotional experience to put yourself in the shoes of that person and see land disappear before your eyes, see family disappear and never come back, see like massive amounts of your communities dying off from sickness, to just really grapple with the realities of colonization and the way that the state had a role in that. And I think that, like, especially as state actors, putting ourselves in that position and the way that we relate to Indigenous communities and thinking about holding reverence and holding truth and space for the fact that, like, yes, the state has not met its promises to these communities. The state has harmed these communities continuously throughout history. And the only way that relationship will ever change, grapple with that history and truth. So being with people in the room, you know, when those like light bulb moments happen, or like those heart open moments happen, where you can see people be like, oh, I was never told this history. And you can see them and hear them start to ask, why was I never told this history? Or another thing that we see and hear a lot is people saying, oh, wow, like my family owns property here and my family has, you know, ancestry here that we're proud of. And I've never taken the time to think of this level of access to land, to property, to resources is so normalized in the story of my family. I've never taken time to think about who didn't have access to those things and why. So it's just such a opening experience. And I know I keep coming back to this like idea of like care and like, but that is the reality of it. And I think it's a reality that we grapple with internally all the time. Like, racial justice work is emotional. It's work. And being able to facilitate spaces in partnership with Wabanaki Reach, where people are invited into that openness, just to start asking questions, I think is so transformative.
So you're listening to Justice Radio with your hosts, Mackenzie Kelly and Linda Small. And today we're talking with Ray Sage, a policy coordinator for the Permanent Commission on the status of racial, Indigenous, and tribal populations, and it to empower, improve, and support the lives of Maine's most vulnerable families and communities. So Ray, before the break, you know, we were talking about training and colonization and, you know, the culpability for the state's harm and also falling short of its promises. And it reminds me a little bit of the Wabanaki Reach, the State Child Welfare Truth and Reconciliation Commission, right? That you talked about truth earlier and how we need to make these things known. And so I love that tie-in. But another piece of that is also the racial disparities in the state. I know the commission last November published a report on racial inequities in Maine. And I wonder if you want to talk about that a little bit and share with our listeners what you learned through that research.
Yeah, absolutely. So our State of Racial Equity report has been so instrumental in really kind of like rooting our work in not only like state specific data, because as we do this work, one of the things that we continuously come up against is the broad perception that Maine is white, inherently white, and that, you know, the conversation about racial inequity, like we still sometimes come into spaces where there's a question of if that conversation is even one worth having. So really the State of Racial Disparities report serves as a testament to like, yeah, we have information about the ways that racialized communities are impacted all across the state, and we have information about it in multiple sectors. And I think the report does a really cool job of also highlighting the like intersections between all of these different issues. And I think one of the things that we always are trying, these disparities are compounding. It's not just a racial disparity in one area of folks' life. It is this labyrinth of where disparities are building upon each other and creating really difficult outcomes in terms of like people's ability to access a healthy, you know, safe, stable life. Work goes into housing, wealth and income disparities, employment, transportation, health and healthcare, child and elder care, public education, criminal legal system stuff, reform, food security, Wabanaki self-determination, and environmental justice. And we're also hoping that this will be a report that I think every 2 years we're hoping to republish. And so we're also asking community actors, like, what did we miss? What's information that could be useful to add to this report to really help paint the picture? And like I said previously, you know, one of the biggest goals of the Permanent Commission is to make, you know, timely, place-specific data available to folks so that it's not on the onus of the Permanent Commission to be the only one doing evaluation of potential racial harms caused by policy and rulemaking, to empower other state actors and community-based organization and anyone who's doing a program that's going to impact communities of color or may in the future, to have that equity-minded lens. So there's like so much rich information in it, in hopes that people will lean on it and give us feedback also on what feels useful, and just kind of continue pushing the needle and getting better data about what's happening to communities in Maine.
That's awesome. Before I go for a follow-up question, a couple of things. Can you expand a little bit about what you discovered when we have this broad perception that Maine is white? Is that because we're sort of invisibilizing other communities? And if so, what does that look like?
Absolutely. You know, I think like identity and place are such like complex concepts, not only to people within their own identities, but in how we think about each other. I think if you were to casually ask someone to, like, you know, draw a picture of a Mainer, I think we all have a pretty linear idea of what they would probably draw. And, you know, even just like within my own identity, like being a Black person who grew up in Maine, when I'm traveling, when I'm abroad, so many times I hear people say, I haven't even had Black people. And, you know, like some of that is like a statistical reality. Like, yeah, like there's like a 2%, you know, 2% Black people here. But I think the truth of history part becomes like a really critical element of that conversation, because there have always been communities of color here. The Wabanaki people of Maine are the indigenous people of this place. They were here first. They are who belongs to this land first and foremost. So when we have these ideas of who occupies a place, we all questions as to why. Like, what happened to mixed race communities in Maine? What happened to the predominantly Black communities that used to be up in the Warren area? Like, what happened to these communities, and why don't they exist in the same way they did in the past? And also, as we're dreaming of the future of Maine, how do we make sure that Maine is accessible to a broad spectrum of people? Because that is an intentional choice. What you invest in terms of infrastructure, what you invest in terms of local services, defines as access to what spaces. So by challenging this idea that Maine is just historically and inherently white, and that's just the way it has been, is to look at the truth of the diversity of Maine, which is so rich and dynamic if you take the time to really look at it, and also challenge this idea that Maine is just white because that's just how it is and how it always has been. So yeah, it's a really rich conversation that we're always having.
That's great. I really appreciate that. I can't imagine growing up in a community where I was the minority, you know. I mean, could you maybe speak a little bit about what that was like for you and how that shaped your position that you're in now?
Oh, I would love to. I have such a deep affection for Maine because of like what it offered me in terms of building a relationship with nature and the outdoors and like water specifically. But it was also extremely jarring. I moved here with my family from Florida when I was 13. I went to Scarborough middle school first. And then when my dad got a job with the state, we moved further inland to Jefferson. And from there, I mostly lived in Jefferson and Washington for all of my high school experience. And I went to Erskine Academy, where I, throughout the years, I was one of like 2 to 3 Black people at any one time. So it was extremely isolating. And it was extremely, you know, trying in terms of trying to figure out my own personal identity in this backdrop of people that it often felt difficult to form strong relationships with, not only on the racial line, but also on the line of being from away, like being, you know, a new person in a school full of people who've like often known each other since birth, it feels like, you know, or and known each other's families. And, you know, so there was like multiple levels of challenge of like feeling connected to the people that I was around. And then, you know, I really, really, really resonate deeply with our work around like education and the uplifting of truth, because that was a constant challenge that I had within my school system. And yeah, like, I think we have our reasonable doubts about the education system throughout the year, but also like, you know, that constant question of like the intentionality about what is taught and what is not. I said earlier also, like realizing that I've always been a political person, like I was like getting into fights with my teachers about what racism was and all the isms and how they were connected. And I was just like, ageism, sexism, like all of these things are like judging someone not based on the caliber of their like work and presence, but like based on something that they cannot control and based on your perceptions of those things. And I literally had gotten into fights with my teachers. During that time, my mom was also going through the naturalization process. And I was like going to school, listening to kids and teachers talk about how it was too easy to become a citizen and like so much harder and so much more rigorous, while I'm going home watching my mom go through the process in real time after living in this country since she was a teenager. You know what I mean? So there was just like all of these kind of polarizing experiences. And I think one of the biggest things that ended up happening is that I just ended up with this like deep desire to get out of here, because I just felt like there were so many parts of myself that would never be appropriately fed or would never feel the type of deep community that I knew was possible from like growing up in like predominantly like Caribbean mixed race communities in Florida, and then moving here and like just being like, I know that there's a level of like intimacy and love and compassion that's possible in community, and I'm not feeling it from the community that I'm around, because so many people were perceiving me as a Black person first and as other first before actually getting to know me as like an individual. So yeah, like I think like that really fed into kind of this like deep desire I had to get out of here. Like when I joined the military, I was just kind of like, I literally told my recruiter to send me on whatever job left soonest, because I tried to go to college and it didn't work out for me financially. And I was just like, I feel like the world is going to collapse in around me if I don't get out of here. And I think that is a feeling that a lot of young people probably grapple with here. I'm listening to my younger brother who just turned 18 grapple with that. He's like, I need to see the world. Like, I need to get out of here. So like one of the questions I'm always asking is like, how do we create a rich enough, dynamic enough landscape in Maine that young people know that they have roots here and know they have a home here? I know one of the reasons I did come back to Maine is because I was seeing more services, more resources, more conversations around communities of color, around Black people in Maine than I had ever seen before, like through social media and through friends and stuff. And I started to believe, I'm like, okay, like maybe there is a place for me there. As much as I love the state and I want to be there, I don't always feel like it loves me back, but I was like, maybe there's a place I could find. And I will say I'm definitely finding those spaces now, which I'm beyond thankful for.
We are so happy to hear that, because the state of Maine and the commission is lucky to have you, Ray. And, you know, I feel for what you went through in the early years, but I also hear you saying it lit a fire under you. And that's what we really need, right? We need passionate people who are driven to help us change things, because we desperately need change in Maine. And I think it's, you know, when I think about who Mackenzie and I generally represent, which are system impacted folk, it's isolation on top of isolation, right? We're kind of stuck in the Northeast corner, and we're always, Maine is always the last to follow national trends. And then you have this subset of people who are either currently incarcerated or formerly incarcerated that have that intersectionality that you talked about earlier, and you layer over having a conviction history on top of that.
Yes.
And it's really an uphill battle just to survive, let alone find ways to thrive. So I appreciate, you know, your personal story and sharing that with our listeners. Thank you so much. Yeah. And so we covered a lot of ground today, but could you share a little bit, like you talked about wanting feedback from communities, organizations, and individuals, you know, how do people find your report and how do people give you feedback on that and generally what's happening with the commission?
Absolutely. So Permanent Commission has a website. We have plenty of resources. We have our reports and also some terminals where you can send messages to the Permanent Commission on our website. And let me pull it real quick. It's PCRITP.me. The Permanent Commission on the Status of Racial, Indigenous, and Tribal Populations. If you Google us, we'll also come up. The Permanent Commission also has an Instagram that you can follow to keep updated on what we have going on. And also, like, if you are, you know, have a burning desire to reach out, please reach out to me also. I'm at ray.sage@maine.gov. So please feel free to reach out and like continue the conversation.
Thank you so much, Ray. I really appreciate you being here and talking with us. Is there anything that we didn't cover today that you would like our audience to know aside from what you've already shared?
For sure. I think just picking up the thread that Linda started about like this fraud bred isolation. It's like this piece that rural communities know all too well. It's this piece that I think a lot of folks of color in Maine have experienced in different capacities. But the isolation piece, it's also a piece that came up in our training for legislators just yesterday. I was talking about the way colonization is so rooted in isolation and separation. You know, like it was the separation of Indigenous people from their land and ways of life. It was also the separation of the people like perpetrating the colonization from their own humanity, because you can't be in touch with your humanity and treat somebody as an object, treat land as a just passive object for income. I think isolation is such a big thing in Maine that people grapple with and struggle with. And the answer on every level is community and really like the work of bringing folks together across sectors, across racial groups, across cultures, so that we can learn and pour into each other. And I think beyond anything else, like, you know, no matter what you believe, no matter what your experience is, there is something to be gained from us finding a way to be in closer relationship to each other. So I always want to uplift kind of that like solidarity idea, because it's so instrumental not only to this work, but to the better quality of life for every single one of us. So
thank you so much, Ray, for the great conversation. I'm sure the audience learned a great deal about the Permanent Commission and why it's so important for Maine. You can visit the Justice Radio Show page on WMPG.org for archived episodes aired on WMPG and WERU and WMHB. A big thank you to Samuel James for his gift of music that opens and closes each episode in our series.